Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, Earth Sky Science Communicator of the Year, Gavin Schmidt. And skywatching the Milky Way is a great way to start 2012. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Most people hear what they know about climate change from a politician, from a headline, from a soundbite, from a joke in the bar, and they don't know where to go. They don't know where to go to get the real information.
That's climate scientist Gavin Schmidt of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Emily Howard and Michael Brennan.
An expedition to explore deep sea hydrothermal vents in the dark abyss of the Southern Ocean near Antarctica has revealed a lost world of creatures, straight out of a Jules Verne adventure. British scientists reported new species of crab, snail, sea star, barnacle, sea anemone, and even octopus. These animals thrive in total darkness, warmed by the vents that release heat from our Earth's interior. We have pictures at earthsky.org. Search for the words lost world.
When 2012 began on January 1st, our planet Earth was very close to its perihelion, its closest point to the sun for the year. In 2012, Earth was closest to the sun on Thursday, January 5th, at 1 Universal Time. That was January 4th at 7 p.m., according to clocks in central United States. How can we be closest to the sun when it's winter? Well, it's actually summer now, south of Earth's equator. Earth's seasons, scientists say, aren't caused by our distance from the sun, but by Earth's tilt on its axis.
As we record this on January 6th, we in the U.S. still haven't seen any significant snows east of the Mississippi River during this winter season. Parts of New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma panhandles have had their share of snow, and Alaska was extremely cold and snowy in December. But most of the U.S. has been without its usual winter snowfall. The models are hinting at a significant change to come in the weather pattern. Not surprisingly, the prediction is for snow in the coming weeks. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Missing Winter.
As 2011 slid into 2012, NASA's two GRAIL spacecraft slipped into orbits around the moon. GRAIL A achieved orbit on Saturday, December 31st, 2011. GRAIL B followed Sunday, January 1st, 2012. GRAIL stands for Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory. This mission is designed to study the gravitational field of the moon by studying minute differences in the distance between the two spacecraft as they orbit over the moon's surface. Scientists say this information will help them understand how mass is distributed inside the moon, and in that way, tell them more about how our companion moon came to be. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Up next is our Song of the Week, Modern World, off the upcoming album Waves for the Ages by Melligrand.
Won't forget the moment. They
We invite you to join our community for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Gavin Schmidt is a climatologist and climate modeler at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He works on the variability of the ocean circulation and climate using general circulation models. He has also worked on ways to reconcile paleo data from many thousands of years ago with state-of-the-art computer models. EarthSky's over 600 science advisors selected Gavin Schmidt as the 2011 EarthSky Science Communicator of the Year. Dr. Schmidt is in the studios of the Radio Foundation in Manhattan now to speak with us about communicating science. Dr. Schmidt, welcome.
Thank you.
First off, congratulations on being selected as EarthSky Science Communicator of 2011, chosen by scientists in our over 600 global science advisors. How do you feel about it?
I think it's great. One of the things that you get from talking quite widely to the public is you end up having a much larger reach than you otherwise would. And it's always surprising to the extent to which that does happen. But it's also a testament to how important that kind of communication is. So I think it's great that these awards exist. I think it's great that I got it. But it's a testament to what we need to be doing as a community.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. Climate scientists aren't typically known for actively engaging the public, as you have through many ways, through your blog, realclimate.org, through interviews on television, radio, news op-eds. You have a recent book, Climate Change, Picturing the Science. What are you trying to achieve in communicating more broadly?
Well, climate change is a topic that people kind of get on a visceral level. I mean, people have experience of the weather. They know what the sea level is. They know what a storm is. They know what temperature is. So it's not a science that is very esoteric in terms of, some kind of microscopic particles or, something that's going on at the scale of the atom or something like that. Climate change is a problem that scientists have brought to the public's attention. And it's something that the public feel that they should be understanding. But what they get instead is generally, sound bites, headlines, politicians talking about this instead of scientists talking about this. And people, I think, are rightly very confused about what's really going on, what's real, what's not real, what's information, what's misinformation, what's disinformation. And because this has become quite a politicized conversation, at least in public, there's a huge need for people who know what they're talking about to input their expertise into that conversation. Because if they don't, then the field is kind of ceded to the people who are only trying to get something done or who have an agenda or who are not interested actually in the real science, but are just interested in using science to push a political point.
What is one thing that you'd like to tell people about climate change?
The one thing that people still ask me, is climate change real? And is it caused by us? And the answer to both of those things is yes. Climate change is real. It's happening now. And as far as we can tell, most of the climate changes right now are being driven by human activities.
Back this up a little bit with a sense of what's happening right now.
Well, I think actually you want to sidestep that specific question, and you want to tell people about what people are doing to study this problem. Who are these people that are going out and measuring ocean temperatures? Who are these people who are tracking the retreat of the Arctic sea ice almost year on year? Who are these people who are going out and measuring the small processes involved in cloud formation, in soil moisture retention, in ocean eddies, in evaporation, that we then put together to build the numerical simulations that I work on, these climate models that we're using to help us piece together what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and what's likely to happen in the future. I think it's far more important that people get a sense of the science as a work in progress than that one particular message gets hammered home, or one particular piece of content knowledge gets hammered home, because this is going to be a continuing problem. You know, it's not just a function of, oh, well, it's happening now, then everything is settled. We know that things are happening. We know pretty well that they're happening because of us. But there's a lot of stuff there. And most of the science news is concerned with, you know, stuff at the cutting edge, stuff at the uncertainty bounds, you know, at the edge of what we know. Very few of the stories that we get are telling people what we know quite well. They're always focused on what's the uncertainty, what the uncertainties are. And that's because that's where scientists are focused. But it isn't necessarily where the public sees the need for information. And so I think there's a huge need for the context. You know, how have we got to where we are in terms of understanding? Why are these stories that are coming out, why are those stories in Nature or Science anyway? You know, what was the process that led to that? And I know that that's more complicated. It's not a soundbite. It's not something that one can encapsulate in a headline particularly. But it is one of the things that I think that scientists can provide much more readily than advocates or journalists or commentators. Is that sense of progression, that sense of science as a process. And when it comes to, you know, making sense of, you know, what should we do? The science says this. This is what's going on. What are our options? People need to know that the science is a process, and that lots and lots and lots and lots of honest and hardworking and intelligent people are working on this and have been working on this for decades and decades.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about communicating science?
I think you can't go wrong communicating about scientists. Tell people what you do, why you get out of bed in the morning, what excites you, why it excites you, and where that's led you. People are fascinated by that story. They're fascinated by that narrative, and they're amazed that the efforts of individuals, like scientists that might be listening to this now, have led to such a profound understanding of how the world works and our place in it. Talk about what you do and why you love it. That's the bottom line.
You've been listening to Gavin Schmidt of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird joined us now with news of the global night sky, the bright stars of early 2012. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. Oh, the evening sky right now is so beautiful, and every year at this time of year, you see many, many bright stars, many, many more bright stars at this time of year than 6 months ago. And in a second, I'll tell you why. But 2012 is especially fantastic because the planets Venus and Jupiter are both up in the evening sky. So if you go outside and you look in the west, you'll see this very bright planet, Venus. Look kind of high in the southeast, and you'll see this very bright planet, Jupiter. And meanwhile, there are all these other bright stars that you see every January in the evening sky around. So it's a beautiful, beautiful time to look at the evening sky.
Yeah, it's a great time to see the planets and the stars. But why is it a good time, particularly a good time to see them now?
Well, what I wanted to tell you about was why the stars, why the winter stars, and now we're not talking about the planets Venus and Jupiter, but actually about the stars themselves. Every year at this time of year, if you go outside, even if the planets aren't there, the stars just look brighter at this time of year, and people always comment about that, and they ask about why that is.
I was wondering, why is that?
Well, one thing you have to remember is that we're on a planet orbiting the sun, and that planet is in a larger galaxy, a huge collection of billions of stars, and we're orbiting not in the center of the galaxy, but about two-thirds of the way out from center. So as our Earth goes around the sun, it's kind of like being on a merry-go-round where you're sort of looking at the snack bar over here on one side of the merry-go-round, and then you're looking at the, you know, the gate where they're collecting the tickets over on the other side of the merry-go-round. Except we're on this planet orbiting the sun, and at part of the year we're looking toward the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and in another part of the year we're looking away from the center. And that's what's going on at this time of year. In the month of January, we're always looking away from the center of the Milky Way galaxy, but we're looking into the spiral arm of the galaxy to which our sun and Earth belong, and that's the Orion Cygnus arm. We're on the inner edge of that spiral arm, and we're actually seeing these very bright stars that are in that spiral arm of the galaxy, and that's why the stars look brighter at this time of year.
I know, it's weird that at this time of year, we're looking out away from the center of our Milky Way galaxy, out away from where most of the stars are, really, but we can actually see more stars in January, early 2012.
Well, it's not actually that we can see more stars. It's that the stars that we do see are relatively closer, and they just look brighter. And plus, we're looking, when you look toward the center of the galaxy, which you do in Northern Hemisphere summer or Southern Hemisphere winter, you're looking toward the center of the Milky Way. That's, say, in the month of August. And, you know, there are many, many more stars in the direction toward the center of the galaxy, but that huge collection of stars gives the night sky kind of a hazy appearance. Like, it's almost as if you're seeing haze, but really that haze is stars if you're in a dark country location. And if you take a pair of binoculars, you know, on an August evening and look up at that hazy night sky, you'll see that haze kind of explode into just billions of stars. But, you know, at this time of year, we're looking opposite that. We're looking toward, you know, our very own spiral arm of the galaxy, the Orion Cygnus arm, looking into that arm. And we're not seeing as many stars, but we're seeing those very bright stars that are nearby. And plus, we're looking beyond those stars into the space beyond the galaxy, the empty space beyond the galaxy, that very dark space beyond our Milky Way's borders.
I hope everyone listening can get a chance to actually do that, to go out to a dark sky and see our spiral arm of this Milky Way galaxy we find ourselves in.
That's right. It's really amazing. The band of the Milky Way, the starlit band of the Milky Way, looks much brighter in the month of August in the evening than it does now. Because you're looking toward the center of the galaxy, it's broader and brighter in our sky. But at this time of year, there's the hazy band of the Milky Way is also there. And instead of looking toward the center of the galaxy, you're looking toward the outer edge. So it's a fainter band, but you can see it in a dark country sky.
Well, thanks, Deborah, for that explanation of why the stars are brighter at this time of year.
You're welcome, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mellow Grand, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, Sleep Good, and Okote Soul Sounds. For more information on science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason. Next stage.